Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. And I think it's obvious to all of us how connected we've become to our personal electronic devices, computers and iPads and iPods, but especially smartphones. As phones have evolved from just being mobile telephones to basically being computers and personal assistants and conduits to the web and social media, connecting directly to everyone we know, and a lot of people we don't know sometimes, through texting and Twitter, they've quickly become indispensable appendages of ourselves. Right? So we're basically addicted to them, some people to the point that they'll risk their lives and occasionally even lose their lives to protect them. They'll jump into the path of an oncoming train, for example, to try to retrieve their dropped phone. There have been a number of cases of people being robbed and told to hand over their phone, have refused, and they're then shot and killed. My guest is Dr. Brian Reuther. He's a psychology professor at Indian River State College in Fort Pierce, Florida, and he studies this phenomenon. He recently published a much-talked-about paper in the Journal of Theoretical and Philosophical Psychology, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome, Dr. Reuther.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I assume I can call you Brian?
That's fine.
Good. So, first, Brian, to kick things off, and maybe start with a little drama, why don't you give us some of the more extreme examples of how extremely attached people are to their smartphone, to the point of, as I said, risking life and limb for them?
This was fairly surprising to me as I was doing some research in the background of the topic. You know, there was a couple cases, and now this is really just the extreme versions of this behavior, where people have actually lost their lives due to these devices or, you know, going after and retrieving these devices. For example, one situation in Chicago in January, very cold period of time at that point, where a person actually broke through the ice of a frozen lake, and two people kind of came up after the person to go rescue them, and only one survived of the three people who went into that lake after that phone. Another situation, again in Chicago, where a person was crushed to death because they went after their smartphone, in a trash compactor, and unfortunately the trash compactor turned on. And this is also a worldwide phenomenon, because in China, several people went into an open toilet pit to retrieve their phone, in which only a handful of people survived the incident, and actually two people died. So this is a pretty serious issue.
Yeah, I read about this in Yahoo Tech News and read about you and your research on it. And it's something I've thought about, too, and probably most people have thought about this growing attachment to smartphones in particular. So what underlies this attachment? I mean, yes, they're a little expensive to lose, but, you know, $100 or $200 or something, but that can't be it that would cause people to jump into basically the bottom of an open outhouse and die in sewage. It's got to be more to it than that. What's entailed in this tremendous attachment to these phones?
Yeah, and I think that there's again, as you mentioned there, there's a part of the financial aspect of it that's significant, but really, what I think is going on here is a profound attachment that we have these devices, as you mentioned. And we can think of attachment in two ways. There's one way which we think of attachment in sort of the everyday definition of it, where it signifies a bond or a connection or perhaps even a fond regard that we have to something. But in the psychological sense, so in the psychological meaning of attachment, it actually means something a lot more significant when it comes to personal relationships. Basically, attachment theory was first created by a psychoanalyst back in the early part of the 20th century by the name of John Bowlby, and was continued by the work of a psychologist by the name of Mary Ainsworth, where they actually observed humans interacting with one another, specifically infants and children, interacting with caregivers, specifically mothers at the time, and noticing the types of relationships they had. And so what attachment describes is both an object, so they're become attached to a parent or a caregiver, and also the behaviors that one exhibits to be able to keep that object, so that parent or that caregiver, in close proximity with them. And so what it does is this satisfies beyond basic nourishment or food needs to profound relational needs. The main goal of attachment is for the infant or the child in early development to have a felt sense of security. And so what happens is when that child forms that attachment with that parent or caregiver, and that parent or caregiver goes away, leaves the room, leaves the situation, the child will react in extreme distress, which is what we call separation anxiety. And we can see that illustrated quite readily if you've observed or perhaps maybe you've even experienced this, dropping a little child off at a school or a daycare or something, and they react, they cry, they get upset when the parent or a caregiver leaves the premise. And so really what happens is that these attachment relationships are not just simply limited to parents or caregivers. They become our basic models for the world. They move on to represent peer groups. They move on to represent other intimate relationships, partners, spouses, those types of relationships, as well as sociocultural entities, religious groups, social groups, culture groups, those types of things. Anything that really constitutes who we are as human beings and what we feel is significant in the world in a relational sense.
So this little device, because of everything that's in it and all the things that it does, I guess what you're saying is it becomes a stand-in or an avatar for all of our other relationships. And that's why people treat it and protect it as if it were their only child, because in a sense, it's their connection to their only child and to everybody else they know. I mean, so it sort of becomes the symbol of all of their intimate family relationships, which sounds crazy on the face of it. But is that what it basically boils down to in terms of this attachment to the phones?
Yeah, I think that's what's going on here to a certain extent. And so what we see oftentimes, think about if you've ever left your cell phone at any place. You left it home if you were going to work or
at a restaurant or something.
Yeah, any place. And what types of responses do people have when they leave these cell phones or leave these devices, these places? Oftentimes, they get very anxious. And some of the behaviors that we've observed people reacting to losing these devices or misplacing these devices is not too dissimilar than the anxious reactions that people have when they lose sight of a loved one or a child lose sight of a loved one early on in their development. So we see a connection there. So yes, I think that these devices become what we would consider physical representations of sort of that social connectedness and also memory devices that are very much a part of who we are as human beings.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's all the pictures that people take. I mean, an iPhone today can take hundreds and hundreds of pictures and store them all. And it used to be things that were, taken with a 35-millimeter camera and developed at, a Photoshop or a drugstore and put in a book, but now you've got them in your pocket all the time. And that's where they are. That's where they reside, right? So then there's personal data and all of your contacts and maybe financial information and bookmarks. So there are different aspects to it that aren't just, I think, personal relationships, but that are related to security and to, as you say, memory, to kind of your own identity in a way, right? All of that's balled up inside this device.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And it's the case that a lot of these aspects, these become sort of physical representations or perhaps even physical extensions of ourselves in a way.
Another thing I noticed, too, is that especially as cell phones began to really take off into the general population and they became, affordable and it became the thing that almost everybody had to have, especially teenagers and so on, it looked to me that maybe for many people, they became a symbol of being attached and of having friends and of not being alone. I mean, it wasn't just the attachment itself that the phone represented, but the appearance of it in a way. And so if you're in a mall and you're a nerdy young guy or a gawky 13-year-old girl or whatever, having a phone to your ear, walking down the street and you're sort of, even homeless people have cell phones. It amazes me, And so walking down the street with a phone to their ear signals that they're connected to somebody. And it says to the world around them, I'm not alone. I'm not just this goofball by myself. I mean, is there some aspect of that, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. These devices have the ability to connect us to people all around the world. That's sort of the positive aspect of it. So if you, are lonely or you feel alone, it's really easy just to reach into your pocket and see what's going on in the Facebook community, see what's going on Twitter. And, that stand-in for some of the relationships make us feel less alone in this world. And so these physical objects can really represent our connections with other people.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Brian Reuther about the extreme connection to personal electronic devices, in particular smartphones. And it's true of other kinds of electronic devices too, but more particularly with smartphones because they embody all of the functions and capabilities that all of the other electronic devices normally did one by one in the past, right? So he's a psychologist, a psychology professor at Indian River State College in Fort Pierce, Florida, and he's researching this this phenomenon. I'll call it kiddingly kind of phonophilia, right, as a psychological condition or whatever. But, you know, kind of switching a little bit to other devices, it's been obvious and observed for many years that a lot of people are addicted to the web, right, through the internet and through their computers, whether it's social media or gaming or porn sites or online gambling or using blogs or just in general surfing the web, it can be a problem, right? For such people, it's a major distraction from work and family and other annoying responsibilities like life, you know? So I was wondering, have smartphones ramped that up and made it worse? Because you used to have to sit at a desk to do it, and now you can do it everywhere.
Yeah, there's definitely a sort of a mobile aspect of this, but before we get into that, I think it's important to discuss what it's meant by addiction. You know, we can really use it in everyday sense as someone, you know, who is constantly on a phone or constantly on a computer, and we might say to them, oh, you're addicted to that thing, because they spend an exorbitant amount of hours on that for perhaps business or pleasure or whatever that might be. The distinction is where it begins to interfere, as you said before, everyday life and one's occupation, social relationships, and even activities in daily living, such as bathing, eating, and also the reaction that the person has when the device is taken away. You know, when they don't have it in their presence or they don't know where it is, what are they? How are they responding? Are they responding anxiously? Are they getting angry? Or those types of things. And that might indicate that the person might even have what we would consider psychological addiction. The only one that's really recognized in any type of form as a disorder would be gambling. But many researchers and clinicians are kind of catching up to the growth and the expansion of technology and suggesting that, yeah, well, I think that the model of addiction, the model of dependency that was being barred by substances here is definitely fitting with these devices. It seems that these issues, you know, were initially just limited to the personal computer. You know, you'd be in your household to be able to engage in these types of things that were internet related and whatnot. But also, you know, since you can carry this device in your pocket, it becomes a whole lot more mobile, you know. And so this aids in people wanting to compulsively check Facebook, compulsively check Twitter, those types of things.
Yeah, so I imagine, like a lot of things in life, it's on a sliding scale, right? So there's a continuum from not being attached to it or even interested at all to being totally addicted. And I guess it, you know, parallels the idea of somebody who's addicted to a quarter pack of cigarettes a day versus four packs of cigarettes a day or something. So I don't know where you draw the line when you call it addiction, but it's, at some point in different people's lives in different circumstances, it becomes a problem. If you're at work and you're surfing the web all the time, or you're constantly texting your friends and you're not doing your work, that's a problem only if you can't get your work done to the extent that ultimately you don't get promoted or you even get fired, you know, so it's like that. But I mean, email, for example, texting is the stripped down version of email. And it used to be when it was computer based that you didn't know you had an email until you got back to your computer and looked at it and called it up and saw it. But now email comes in continually on your phone, no matter where you are, even driving, you know, which is dangerous. So, I mean, I guess this, to me, it's just ramped up the phenomenon in scale and scope to where it's a bigger problem, I would think. I mean, I tend to view some of these things as a really serious problem. I don't know. Do you?
Yeah, I think they definitely do have a potential to be a very significant problem in this world. You know, especially when you get in a situation where individuals are receiving text messages while they're operating a motor vehicle. You know, and you see a lot of publicity about that. In different news sources about people getting into accidents and people, losing their lives because of receiving a text message while they're operating a vehicle of some sort.
You mentioned a while ago about people constantly checking their Facebook page, and that, you know, it's funny with that. I think it started with adolescence, but it's become a more pervasive thing among older adults now, even to the point of being an obsession, I think, for many people to constantly check that and post trivial stuff. I mean, a lot of people react to it as it's just, you know, your day-to-day trivia of your life. Who's really interested in that? I guess a lot of people are interested in that to the extent that it's very involving for a good percentage of the population. But you know, getting back to the idea of whether it's good or bad, these things in a broad general way, obviously there have been revolutions fomented based on social media, you know, where the message and the organizing principles behind it are broadcast out via social media. And that can be a good thing if you're overthrowing a dictator or whatever, but it's also a bad thing if it's extremely destructive to your productivity or to your relationships with your family and that kind of thing. So, Brian, do you have a general sense overall of whether social media in particular, just to look at that aspect of it, which includes Twitter and so on, whether on balance it's a good thing or a bad thing in the world?
This is a very complex issue because you're right. You know, it is the case that entire revolutions have been created, you know, with different social media devices to be able to organize people in certain locations to be able to, you know, get a political message across and those types of things. But I think that we need to understand that this phenomenon in technology, and technology is one of those things that's here to stay, you know, and it's going to continue to ramp up. It's going to continue to expand. There's a large consumer base for it, and it's going to continue to expand in that way. And we have to really understand both the strengths and the limitations, both the positive and the negative aspects of these phenomena. Yes, you know, on the one hand, it can connect us with people all over the world. Mm-hmm. It can, you know, get people together with similar ideologies to be able to institute change in their local or perhaps even national governments. But at the same time, we'll run the risk of it really diluting our sense of selves. It really runs the risks of us losing who we actually are into and becoming absorbed into these devices. You know, and I kind of see it in this sort of more negative aspect of it, where it may promote two forms of extremes, where one being complete self-absorption, where the person feels that he or she is at the center of attention. And this is fueled by the immediate gratification they get in the form of response, you know, where they maybe post a picture of themselves and they get likes or they get comments. And, you know, even a response that may not be positive in that regard is still a response, and they still matter in some way. Another thing that's related to this absorption is where you get absorbed in the lives of other people, you know, where you're following all these celebrities on Twitter or you're following other people that you may or may not even know in your life on Facebook. And you get so absorbed in what they're doing and what they need to, what they're doing in their lives, and you may become disconnected in your own life in a way.
Yeah, and there's the aspect of, particularly for more vulnerable people psychologically, teenagers and so on. I mean, occasionally we'll hear about a teenage girl who kills herself because she was unfriended on her Facebook page by a number of people. So I think it amplifies the kind of the bullying propensity or the intense focus on popularity and unpopularity in teenagers and adolescents, you know, so that's an aspect of it. But, you know, I mean, the flip side of that, the good part is that it allows people to stay connected, as you've said, you know, a number of times here in the show. You know, the grandparents living in Seattle can stay connected to the grandkids in Miami almost as if they're down the street, you know, in every way except physically. And Skype and things like that help too. But so, you know, there are many good aspects to it. But for every good aspect, there's a flip side that where it's negative. I mean, maybe 50 years ago, a pedophile living in a small town might think he was the only pedophile in the world and he would just keep it under his hat and not do anything about it and control himself or whatever. And now they find a community of people, you know, on blogs and user groups and so on, where they suddenly feel empowered and normalized by realizing that there are all kinds of people who share the same proclivities, right? And so they then act out on things and share things and plan things together that they would have never had the opportunity to do before social media and the internet in general. So, you know, we're kind of verging into a different topic in a way, the kind of the good and the evil of the internet, but it's connected to what we were talking about as the core of this show, which is the attachment, the extreme personal attachment to these devices and to the technologies that empower them. So any comments on all that?
Yeah, you know, one thing that's kind of bring us to our core topic here and related to smartphones is really the nature and how these cell phone devices, these smartphones, are changing intimate family relationships. And you made the connection there with, grandparents across the country or in a different part of the world or whatever can connect with grandchildren, you know, in a different part. And that's a great thing. And so while, you know, these devices can and are oftentimes used for those purposes, they've also impacted significantly how we relate to each other in other ways too. Now, you know, you have sort of the classic picture, you know, of a family sitting down at dinner time, right? You know, together discussing perhaps maybe the triumphs and the struggles of the day. Perhaps they're solidifying relationships or maybe working out family problems and those types of things. But there's that fundamental image of them communicating to each other face to face, perhaps sharing different types of glances, maybe even having some physical connection and those types of things. And it seems to me that nowadays that image needs to be replaced by an image where you see the family members perhaps in the same room, but maybe they're eating in different places. And each one of them is on their own smartphone where there's no physical verbal communication and really no closeness in the way of like a relational sense. And if you want to really find out what each member of the family did that day, don't ask them personally. Check Facebook, check Twitter, check Instagram, because that's probably the most accurate information of what's going on. So it seems like that former image is being replaced by that latter image I just described.
There was an ad on TV recently where a family is at, I guess, Disney World or Universal Studios or something, and the teenage daughter is walking along in a disconnected way with her mother and father and maybe her older brother or something, and she's looking at her phone walking along like you see people doing all the time now. Instead of interacting with the people in the world around them, they're on their phone. And at a certain point, dad suddenly gets a ping and looks at his phone, and he brightens up, and because she has sent him a text with a photo, I guess, saying, "Awesome, Dad, I'm having a great time," or whatever. And he's all happy about that, but they're standing 2 feet apart. Yeah, you know, and I've been out, for example, to dinner with my nephew and a friend of his, and then seen them sitting, you know, 2 chairs away from each other, you know, 5 feet away, texting each other rather than talking to each other. So it empowers communication, but it's a disconnect between people to a great extent. The image you were talking about of the Ozzie and Harriet, you know, around the dinner table, the image of that configuration of the family compared to what you described as an alternative of people in different rooms communicating through their devices with each other. I don't know. The one's three-dimensional and the other's two-dimensional, it seems like to me. I don't know if it's a good thing. I think it's not, obviously. That's what I'm saying.
You know, and I also think that it can get worse than that, if you can imagine that. You know, we're to a point where I've actually spoken to people, and they've been in situations where people have actually felt like they had to compete with the smartphone for the attention of a loved one or a significant other.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so the idea is the person's on the phone and they're wanting to engage with the loved one or significant other in some fashion. And they're simply not paying attention. They're simply just not there. They are not present.
Sure.
They're sort of dissociated in a way from their present moment. And I think the really insidious thing about this is where it becomes impactful in those early attachment relationships with parents and children, where a child needs a lot of attention in the way of, you know, I'm here, you know, spend time with me and, you know, help me do this and help me explore and help me figure things out. I want to engage. I want to talk. I want to be affectionate towards you and those types of things.
Mm-hmm.
Where children might want to engage with a parent or a caregiver in that way, but that parent or caregiver is perhaps maybe too busy on the phone to be able to grab those special moments, you know, with a child to be able to really make a memory.
Yeah, it's a disconnect. So I think there must be demographic differences in this because it is a worldwide phenomenon, right? So, you know, are the industrialized, developed world where it's more affluent and technology is more pervasive, is it a bigger deal in Western Europe and North America and so on than it is in Asia? I mean, it may be some odd flip side to that where there's less wired communications. I think that the growth of mobile technology has been much bigger in Africa and Asia and places where there aren't phone lines and so on. So there's that. But I'm also thinking about differences in education and between men and women and differences in income levels and age. You know, so there are lots of demographic characteristics where this may differ. Where do you think it's most prevalent or most likely to be a problem?
Well, I believe that from what I've seen, some of the research that I've seen, that the demographic from probably about 25 to 34-year-old, and even a little bit younger than 25, there seems to be a big correlation between that age range and the more disposable income that they have to be able to spend on these devices, because some of them can be very costly. But I think there's also an issue what's emerging from that in that way, is that based upon that demographic, they're becoming a symbol of power, status, and social connectedness. So the idea is that people might start to sacrifice other types of things to be able to afford these devices so that they could be, you know, amongst, you know, what everybody else is doing, or amongst the more powerful elite, or whatever the case may be. That's when it comes to smartphones. As far as, like, cell phone use, though, I was just looking at a Pew Research Center fact sheet on cell phone users in the year 2014. And the numbers actually that I saw there didn't really differ much from any type of age, gender, demographic, or even socioeconomic status, or even race or ethnicity. From what I saw across genders, around 90% of individuals had a cell phone.
Wow.
You know, so this is a lot of people. 58% from the same survey had a smartphone. So you can see that obviously cell phones are becoming are a lot more popular. There's a lot more of them out there than necessary smartphones.
Hmm.
Again, with socioeconomic status, it didn't vary very much. It was anywhere from 88 to 92% of people from, you know, below $30,000 a year upwards to $100,000 plus. And as far as the age demographics are concerned, sure, 18, 29-year-olds, about 98% of them own cell phones. And that number started to dip as you got to the sort of the older generations, but it only got to about 74% for 65 plus.
That's interesting. It just shows the priority that these things that people place on these devices in their lives as status symbols and as tools and as personal extensions of themselves, like we've been saying. Back in the late 1960s, a communications professor, I think in Canada, named Marshall McLuhan, predicted the emergence of the global village, which has become kind of a catchphrase. But I think people at the time thought he was talking about TV, but he was really predicting, without even knowing it, the internet, you know, maybe 20 years before its time. And he's become seen as a visionary, and he was then too, but he really did describe the way the internet brings everybody together, regardless of physical distance now. And we've been talking about the ways that's good and bad. Brian, we have just a minute or so left in the show, but how do you think this phenomenon will evolve in the future? Will Siri on the iPhone become more like the computer in the movie Her, which is an avatar in their mobile device that they actually love and live for? I mean, will it get to be more and more like what we've been talking about, and where people are more and more disconnected from the real world?
Yeah, you know, I think that technology, you know, is here to stay. And you see movies like you just mentioned, which, you know, kind of fringe on science fiction. But I don't think it's too far in the future here.
Hmm.
Technology invades our mind space in a metaphorical way. And it's probably a matter of time before it starts to invade us more physically, you know, where we might have some type of neural implant to be able to, you know, what's going to replace our cell phone, you know, so that we can simply communicate with somebody just by thinking it. So it's where it's going to actually start to invade not only our mind space in a metaphorical way like it's doing now, but also in a physical way as well. And I think the most important thing, though, is just to be aware of the disconnecting, the dissociative impact that technology can have so that we can really put first what's important, and that's human relationships.
Interesting and possibly scary. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Dr. Brian Reuther, thanks you so much for being on with us on American Variety. It's been interesting.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.